This is a Times Online podcast.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers. Welcome to issue 41 of The Bugle for the week beginning Monday, the 18th of August, 2008. What a year it's been. With me, Andy Zaltzman, in the Scottish capital of Edinburgh, and in New York City, Mr. John Oliver.
Hello, Buglers. Hello, Andy. Very much in that order. How are you, Andy?
I'm all right, thanks, John, although I slightly hurt my ankle yesterday. But other than that, I'm fine.
Not interested in you or your ankle. Well, actually, no, I'm interested in you, but your ankle I've always hated, so the fact it's in pain it brings nothing but pleasure to me. It's the worst ankle of it. Is it the left one or the right one?
Left, John. If you disrespect my ankle, you disrespect me and my family and my people.
It's just another kind of anti-Semitism. I've had a couple of interesting things happen this week, Andy. I interviewed the Iraqi ambassador to the UN, and it was a situation where I'm not sure that either of us knew quite what we, or indeed the other one, were doing sitting there. It was a strange standoff. I think it might be the closest I've been to being a cowboy. It was like high noon, but with words. And I also met Pierce Bush, the nephew of the current commander-in-chief, who came to our show for reasons best known to him and his party planner. And it was obviously he's not his uncle, I know that, but it was extremely hard to resist just slapping him once straight across the face. Not because I'm angry with him, just because of the opportunity for him to pass that along. Oi, give that to your uncle. Kaplowie!
As always, some sections of The Bugle go straight in the bin. This week, some free squabbling accessories for fans of the bicker, the spat, and even the full-blown Barney, including such phrases for your arguments as, I can't hear you, I'm not a dog. That's a good point, but it would be an even better one if you weren't pointing a gun in my face. Go what, myself? No, you shove it there. And actually, I think you'll find it was Martina Navratilova who said that. Plus, the ultimate argumentative retort, I do not recognise the legitimacy of this court. So use that in your everyday arguments, also a guide on how best to say humph, and when is the best time to cry during an argument, early and excessive, or late and manipulative. Also in the bin, to mark the A-level results coming out in Britain, a free A-level for all our school-aged Bugle listeners across the world. We can offer you a C-grade in bugling.
Top story this week, and surprise, surprise, it's Georgia. Almost as we were recording the last Bugle, Russian tanks were rolling over the Georgian border, perhaps cleverly using the Bugle as a distraction, knowing that world attention was either focused on the Olympic opening ceremony or the recording of the Bugle, possibly both. The undeniable truth, Andy, is that the Bugle and the opening ceremony of the Olympics had a combined audience of billions. Let's not break down who contributed what to that total. That would just be crass. The point is, it was something of a revival show for Russia. Soviet-era tanks rolling across fields. It was like a Cold War reunion tour. Hard not to feel a little nostalgic for a simpler time when the enemy was a tangible nation rather than an abstract concept. It's good to have it back. And you do get the feeling that both the US and Russia have missed each other, although neither would admit it.
Well, I have to say, thank God, John, that it happened during the Olympics. Otherwise, I would have had to give a real shit about this war. But luckily, it's really hard to keep track of things in detail when there's so much quality badminton on. It seems to me that basically what happened is that Georgia attacked itself. Russia retaliated to protect its neighbour Georgia from the attack by Georgia. Then Georgia had a pop at Russia for stepping in to protect itself. And then Russia got confused and actually attacked Georgia, thinking it was Russia attacking itself. But they can all have a good laugh about it now, because peace has broken out, and this issue is dedicated to the peace in South Ossetia.
See, when you break it down, it's actually a lot simpler than it sounds. There is, at the time of recording now, a tenuous French-brokered ceasefire, which could collapse at any time between now and you listening to this, or indeed any time between now and the end of this sentence. And I'll tell you what we in the West are actually going to do about this situation, Andy. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. We have no troops available to do anything and absolutely no remaining moral authority over situations like this to justify action anyway.
It's not really about action, though, John. The important thing is that a lot of political dicks are being swung in very large pendulums, and that is really the most important thing about this.
That, That is a good point. John McCain this week stated, "I think I'll speak on behalf of all Americans when I say we're all Georgians now." Now, that sounds like something, but don't worry, it's nothing. It's absolutely meaningless. Also, it's important to point out that John McCain does not speak for all Americans. His best case scenario at the moment is to be able to speak for 51% of them, maximum. But even that seems like a bit of a stretch. So we have sent these verbal missiles over to Georgia to help our allies over there. And I think that's us pretty square now, Andy. I mean, yes, they have currently contributed the third largest amount of soldiers in Iraq after the US and the UK. But in many ways, our words are our soldiers. And they're fighting incredibly bravely for the Georgians at the moment. I just wish they'd support our words rather than ridicule and criticise them. If the pen is indeed mightier than the sword, then the mouth must be mightier than a missile. So Russia can really fire as many missiles as they like, but they'd better be prepared for our mouths to tut at them after they've done it.
So the Georgians and the Russians went at it hammer and tongs for a short while. It was a bad-tempered contest, no quarter given, no prisoners taken, and squabbles carried on even after the end. And that was just the women's beach volleyball at the Olympics.
Kaboom!
It was a win for Georgia in this case. No finer way to resolve the lingering differences that inevitably spill over from a war than getting two pairs of ladies to whack their bikinis on and dive around in a sandpit. The only problem was that the Georgian pair were actually both Brazilian, which means that Brazil is now at war with Russia. And this is how world wars start, John. Although maybe actually we can bring peace to Georgia by just replacing the entire Georgian population with Brazilians, and their samba beat would soon calm the Russian army down.
If only Hitler and Goebbels had slapped on bikinis and taken on Churchill. Well, who would Churchill's ideal volleyball partner be?
You know, Roosevelt obviously was a big partner in the war, but how good he'd have been at volleyball. You know, he'd just be weak on the spike.
He wouldn't have been bad on a flat surface. It's the sand. It's the sand that would slow him down. His defence would be exposed. It's the sand that would be a problem. The bikini he'd carry off, no problem.
Really hard to know which side to take, and it's nice to take sides in a war. And the blame for this war has been thrown around like a 96-year-old woman who accidentally entered a professional wrestling tournament. Perhaps because Russia and Georgia have shown the same level of flexibility as that self-same 96-year-old woman the following day, when, after a rather embarrassing defeat in the ring, she mistakenly entered a gymnastics competition instead of the mortuary. Because rigor mortis is not great for gymnastics, as both Olga Korbut and Mary Lou Retton can testify. Neither of them had it. They both won Olympic gold. Point proved. It can't just be coincidence.
So, how have Russia responded to the international criticism coming their way? Well, they've referred to the idea of Georgian territorial integrity as an irrelevance. Uh-oh, those are literally fighting words. There have been some extremely bizarre comments from the US. McCain showed his anger by saying, "In the 21st century, nations don't invade other nations." Whoa, hold on there, Johnny Mac. Yes, they do. We just did. In fact, technically, we're still doing it. He has the memory of an irresponsible goldfish. It is testament to how badly we're handling this situation that we're even managing to make Vladimir Putin look good. And at least we've learnt one thing from all this, and that's that I guess we all now know the answer to who is running Russia at the moment. I'm not saying there was any point in when we didn't really know that answer, but at least now we know our instincts were correct. Putin's true colours have come shining through, and those colours are what I like to call 1970s red. It's an iconic shade of rouge. Went out of style for a bit, but I think it's due a comeback. In fact, Dmitry Medvedev has been reduced to occasionally popping up on TV after Putin and essentially saying, yeah, exactly.
Grabbing his crotch with a big medallion.
Exactly. I couldn't and wouldn't dare consider saying it better myself.
So on another extraordinary thing said on this conflict, a former US ambassador to the United Nations, while slamming Russia, said that Russia were basically not a superpower anymore and described them as being Saudi Arabia with trees. And it's good to see that level of trash-talking coming back into international politics.
Oh, my God. That is yo mama-style international relations.
I think what he might have meant is Saudi Arabia with a massively superior military, but he said trees.
Potato, potato. So, Andy, how do you put a lid on all this tension? Well, how about America signing a missile defence treaty with Poland?
Good idea.
No, it's not a good idea, Andy, because it turns out that's not so much putting a lid on it as finding the lid, dusting it off, and then smashing that lid to pieces with a hammer.
Well, I think it is putting a lid on it, John, but as you know from cooking, putting a lid on things makes them boil faster. Other news now, and cities in northern England are done for. According to a report from a think tank, places such as Liverpool, Sunderland and Bradford are, quote, beyond revival and their residents should move south in search of a better life. But, John, such is the influence of think tanks in England that since this report came out, thousands and thousands of northerners have upped what paltry sticks they have in their northern slums and started the long, bleak march south in search of a better life and a tastier breakfast. A humanitarian crisis has unfolded before our British eyes, John. A human Mississippi of refugees flooding south down the A1, the M1, the M6 and even the M6 toll, if they're slightly better off, carrying whatever repugnant northern belongings they can muster from their concrete abominations, wrapped up in a copy of this think tank's report. It's like Afghanistan, but worse. But luckily, Conservative leader David Cameron sprang to this nation's defence, and he called the report insane. And such is the influence of opposition leaders in England, John, that the northern refugees instantly turned round and headed back home just to check whether or not they had anything left to live for. So the status quo has luckily been re-established.
Well, I think I find this story especially hard to stomach, Andy, because my family are actually from the north. A spokesman for this ludicrous report said there are better opportunities in the south in the 21st century, just as in the 19th century there were better opportunities in the north. Whoa! 19th century! You're saying the last time it was worth living up north was around the Industrial Revolution? Well, congratulations! You just made it worse. I didn't think that was an option, but you took it.
This think tank, which I think in this case is a septic think tank, is called Policy Exchange. And in this case, they appear to have exchanged this policy for their marbles. But perhaps there is more to this suggestion than meets the eye, John, because if nice towns and cities of southern England, with their streets paved with pavements, their coffee shops, their tennis courts and their indoor sleeping facilities, if we took in the entire population of the north, then these towns too would begin to appear hopelessly stagnant, crowded, dead ends. And the population would then flood back north, so the entire process would become self-repeating. Within 10 years, the entire population of England will be migrating up and down the country once a fortnight. And due to the shifting weight of people, England will start swinging up and down like a seesaw, which would be great fun and take our minds off the worries of the modern world. Boingy, 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 England will go up and down without a care in the world until a few million people fall off and graze their kneecaps, and all seesaws will be banned, and Brussels will get its way. And that's what this whole thing's about, John.
Good verbose point, Andy.
Some people have been sceptical about the Conservatives' response to this report, John. Partly, I think, because the Conservatives spent much of the 1980s apparently trying to finish off in the North what the Luftwaffe had started. But David Cameron described this report as being insane. I think insane is a bit strong. I think obviously wrong would have done it. Insane would have been to suggest that Liverpool, Sunderland and Bradford were hiding in your shed with a pickaxe and were going to kill you unless you hunted down and kidnapped all of the hit US girl band Pussycat Dolls.
Was he not essentially just trying to quote Cypress Hill there, Andy? Insane. Got no brain. This report is insane in the membrane. Crazy insane. Got no brain.
I think quite possibly. He wouldn't be the first Conservative leader to quote Cypress Hill. Harold Macmillan was the first, I think.
That's right, where's his famous speech, A to the mother K, homeboy, A to the K. Just so you know, I am out of Cypress Hill lyrics, but I did have those two somewhere in me. And I don't know how they got there or why they got there, but they were there and now they're out.
David Cameron talked about the successful regeneration there has been in cities like Liverpool, and he even mentions the Albert Dock in Liverpool, John, which clearly shows to me, John, that he has never done a gig in the Baby Blue nightclub on a Friday evening. Because I think they've still basically got little white chalk outlines of both mine and John's sets from gigs in that club.
I'll certainly take that, yeah. They took me down. In fact, Birmingham, Andy, where I was born, of course, also hit the news this week when it turned out that 720,000 pamphlets congratulating the city on its recycling efforts, in fact, featured the image of a skyline which didn't seem to feature a single recognisable building from Birmingham, which may have been because the image was from Birmingham, Alabama. That's easily done, Andy, easily done. I mean, maybe that's the ultimate compliment. They've improved the Midland skyline by moving it to Alabama. Well done, everyone concerned in that very brief internet search. US candidates' news now, and some like to choose candidates simply on party affiliation, others like to look closer at their policies. The rest of us like to judge them on their music taste, and luckily this week, the candidates have given those people all they need to make a partially informed choice. Each candidate have revealed their top 10 songs. The only crossover between the two candidates was Frank Sinatra. Pretty good crossover. McCain had two ABBA songs in his top 10, with Dancing Queen at number one, and Take a Chance on Me at number three. I don't know, Andy, if I want the leader of the free world listening to ABBA. For some reason, that spooks me out.
Did they just ask him while he was at a bad wedding and carried away by the disco moment?
I don't mind him listening to it maybe in general, but I'm not keen on it being his favourite song in the world, in the history of recorded music. Well, Obama's top song was the Fugees' Ready or Not. He also chose Kanye West's hit Touch the Sky at number six, and Yes We Can by will.i.am at number 10, which is based on his speech, Andy. That is a bit arrogant. Or indeed, maybe, just enormously contrived by campaign staff.
No, don't be so cynical.
Is there anything worse than politicians carefully picking music they think will make them more appealing to like? It's like regressing to being 11. When he was in Europe, David Cameron gave Obama some CDs by The Smiths, Radiohead and Gorillaz. There is no way he likes those bands, Andy. No way. I do. I love all of those bands, and yet he's somehow managing to ruin them for me by picking them.
Well, we used to politicians tell us what music they've been told to tell us they're listening to in an effort to make them look less like aloof and different careerists, which in fact only has the effect of making them look more like aloof and different careerists, which ironically, aloof and different careerists were an indie band that ex-Tory party chairman Cecil Parkinson used to play bass guitar in the late 1980s.
Oh.
That's a fact. But a disappointing result in these two lists of 10 favourite songs for the Australian children's entertainer and artist Rolf Harris. And also bad news for controversial gangster rappers NWA, who again missed out. Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, Eazy-E and MC Ren are reported to be devastated, John, but are now concentrating fully on their preparations to go for gold in the Coxless Fours in Beijing.
They're going to find that very difficult, seeing as Eazy-E died 15 years ago.
You know, away from the boat, in terms of preparation, he brings so much feel-good factor to that team that they're happy to carry him.
It's just team spirit. If they're willing to lug his corpse from one end of that course to the other, then fine.
Yep, the Brits did it with Steve Redgrave. He died in a car crash in 1995.
Feature section now, and the Olympics. Well, Andy, I've done it again. Once more, I've developed a dysfunctional relationship with the Olympics. I've found myself every night this week fighting sleep at 2 a.m. to watch a sport that I know, deep down, I have no interest in. Do I need to watch the Croatian men's water polo team in action? No. Am I transfixed by their moustaches and the sport's seeming encouragement on people drowning each other? Yes, I am.
I guess what the Olympics really have shown us is that the big question we need to ask is Dalai who for the next week or so? Let's just all forget about that because there's been some sensational sport. Michael Phelps, obviously the big star so far. So much for all Americans being overweight and lazy, John. This guy's like a cross between a baguette and a speedboat. I mean, not as fast as a speedboat, but faster than a baguette. Really good at swimming. He's really good at swimming. I'll stand by that.
It's very different, Andy, watching the Olympics over here in America because they win things all the time. I mean, every day they win stuff, Andy. It's fantastic. Phelps alone is giving you more than one gold medal a day. We should get someone like him on our swimming team. Can't believe no one's thought of it. Of course, now this actually means that Britain is winning a lot of gold medals if you, like me, do not recognise American independence. So, well done us. Michael Phelps is a proud British man. The Queen must be thrilled at that manfish.
Also, I don't recognise Chinese independence, John. For me, after the Boxer Rebellion in the early part of the 20th century, we basically ought to own China. So we are miles and miles ahead.
The Olympics began a week ago with an opening ceremony which proved that, yes, there is at least one plus side to human rights abuses. Because you simply cannot put on a show like that unless the performers live in fear of their lives.
I think what the opening ceremony did show, John, is that the more human rights abuses you're trying to hide, the more spectacular a show you're going to put on. So I just hope that London learns from this and the government is encouraged to really clamp down on women.
It even featured a number of Chinese performers physically running over a giant globe in what has to be the least subtle threat to the rest of the planet in games history.
Also at the opening ceremony, John, it turns out that the young 9-year-old girl who sang there mimed, and that a less attractive girl sang. Because apparently, in this display of China to the world, the girl they used had to be, quotes, flawless in appearance.
Oh boy.
And if you think that was creepy, just don't look at the medals table and compare it with one from 20 years ago.
The big thing I took away from the opening ceremony, Andy, was that we in London are f***ed in 4 years. Because we cannot do anything approaching that as an opening ceremony. The way I said, we've got two options. One, become a violent dictatorship. Or two, do the first ever sarcastic opening ceremony. We could do that, you know, play each nation's anthem sarcastically as they parade around looking a little bit insulted. There have been some controversies already at the Olympics. The Spanish basketball team took a photograph from an ad campaign back home, which involved them pulling their eyes with their fingers to make them look slanted. Oh, boy.
Are you sure this wasn't from the Olympics in 1908 rather than 2008?
I'm afraid not, Andy. In fact, Pau Gasol, one of the players who also plays here for the Lakers, said, "I was supposed to be funny or something, but never offensive in any way. I'm sorry if anybody thought or took it the wrong way and thought that it was offensive." What? Everyone finds that offensive. That is the international language of racism. It transcends language.
So who is there to look out for in the second week of the Olympics? Well, a few Bugle picks for you now. We recommend looking out for Stanton Krug of South Africa in the barroom brawling. Unrivaled bottle technique and an almost supernatural ability to hear non-existent insults in other people's conversation. That could be crucial in front of a big crowd at the Olympics, John. Krug's biggest rivals could be the recently divorced Uzbek army reject Rahim Temzamian. He's got a lot of issues to work out. And British Thug of the Year 2007 Mike Prange, veteran of over 200 banning orders. Also, in fruit description, the Romanian star Constantina Florinescu's brilliant description of a ripe apricot as, quotes, a velvety extravagance of peach-like delight, a journey into the very heart of succulents, may have won her the European title last year, but will she choke on the big stage again like in Athens in 2004 when, with the gold at her mercy, she lost it completely and said that a pineapple was like a rabid mongrel dog trying to play the harmonica? Featured drugs of the week at the Olympics this week are croniflambutamol, a steroid which boosts female gymnasts' ability to look like they haven't been psychologically scarred by years of being aggressively hothoused into not falling off planks, and embutrothragogrotine, a mind-doping drug favoured by pole vaulters that makes them think they're being chased by a man-eating rhinoceros, which is scared of people falling onto big mats from a height of over 5 metres. And now a special Bugle Olympic quiz question, and there's a prize if you do get this question right. You can win a full-size working tungsten replica of British gymnast Beth Tweddle, or an audio souvenir of Michael Phelps impersonating a dog. Here it is. Or this week's star prize, a place in the final of the women's 100 metres at the 2012 Olympics in London. And the question is, why was legendary distance runner and 9-time gold medalist Paavo Nurmi banned from the 1932 Olympics? Was it A, because Nurmi, like many sportsmen, was superstitious? After winning his first gold in Antwerp in 1920, he vowed never to change his lucky socks as long as he kept winning gold medals. Following 5 more golds in 1924 and another in 1928, Nurmi was all set to take to the track in 1932 with feet that had not seen the light of day for 12 years, but his lucky socks were judged to be an environmental hazard. The Nazis later stole Nurmi's lucky socks and used them as a chemical weapon on the Eastern Front. Or was it because B, Nurmi was alleged to have received excessive travel expenses to a meeting in Germany? The IOC were real dicks in those days, although Nurmi did claim that a donkey ride in a park in Hamburg had cost $23 million. Was it because C, Nurmi had hatched a plan to hijack the Los Angeles Games to make propaganda points for the Mormons? Or D, because Nurmi swore too much? The 1932 Games were the first to be broadcast on radio, and the authorities were concerned that a repeat of Narmo's 1928 victory cry as he crossed the line of "Bollocks, tit, I've won the gold and you're f***ing shit," would cause too many complaints. A, B, C, or D.
Your emails now, and Andy, this is an email solely for you. And it says, Monsieur Zaltzman. Well, that's probably wound you up already. this is from an Impala. I would write to both halves of the Bugle, but I'm afraid it is only a certain Andrew Zaltzman with whom my wrath resides. How dare you call my neck stupid? How dare you label all of my relatives who are dead at the hands of lions as complacent? We are planning our revenge against lions at this very moment, and guess what? Now it's not just lions who are our intended targets. A certain British comedian has also made us very, very angry. I would have assumed that you, of all people who are a member of the Jewish tribe, would understand what it is to be downtrodden. And yet, you insult the tribe of Impalas who, like the Jews, are long-suffering, guilt-ridden and extremely skilled at kvetching. Yes, we are fated to be hated by Impala haters such as you, but we are nevertheless the chosen ones. The day will come when we will rise again, and on that day, Zaltzman, be ready. You will grow to regret your words when you find yourself on the wrong end of our twisty horns. The day is coming. Our prey will first be lions, but rest assured, you are second in line. Yours, Ignatius Impala. And he signed with an X, sign of the vengeful Impala. Well, Andy.
I've been kind of gripped by a kind of cold sweat.
Looks like you, like Jay-Z, have now got yourself a high-profile beef.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to have to work my way out of this by eating any Impala that I come across.
That sounded like a declaration of war.
I can't back down, John. You know, the Bugle's got standards to keep up. We can't show weakness in the face of Impala.
We don't... No. Don't drag me into this,
go
Andy.
On to
that
team,
was
John.
Your rant.
There's no I in Bugle.
But there is a U. There is a U in Bugle, Andy.
There is also a G. And this email comes from Aaron Hanna, who writes, "Dear Jonathan and Andy Burt, I'm but a simple listener of the Bugle with way too much time on his hands. I decided to take some of this extra time to expand the Bugle's pitifully diminutive page on Wikipedia, Andy's favourite source of random information. Not just favourite, but only. Your page now has more info, but it's still pretty small and rough, considering I didn't use any sources following you guys' journalistic integrity. Therefore, I'm going to ask you a favour. Read this email out loud on the Bugle as a missive for all listeners to flock to the Wikipedia article for the Bugle and edit it into a towering temple of Bugleness, Johnosity, Andiation and non-factuality." Good words. "If every listener contributes just one little bit to the page, you guys will finally have the enormous presence you deserve on the world's greatest misinformation source. That's true power." So, a call to arms from Aaron Hannah. Thanks very much for that, Aaron. And we now exhort all Bugle listeners to put a lie on our Wikipedia page. No facts allowed. We want to try and expand the Bugle page so it contains nothing but outright fibs. And do keep your emails flooding into thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. Just a quick sports section now. Quick preview of the Premiership season, which starts over the weekend. John, it's still literally anyone's, the English Premiership. Huge excitement here in Britain over who could finish 13th. It's open to any one of 16 of the 20 clubs in the league. It really is that exciting.
Well, this is my favourite time of year, Andy, when you look at the table, no games played, and it's just arranged in terms of the alphabet. I believe it should just be alphabetised all the time, Andy.
Yeah, but you just know that Man United would change their name to Man United. A couple of the smaller clubs have been trying to buy their way to success. Hull City have blown their entire transfer budget on a lucky turnip. And Middlesbrough have employed former Blairite spin doctor Alistair Campbell to try to convince fans that the team have won even after they've lost. And just time for a quick Bugle forecast. John, the forecast this week is, it's my wife's birthday on Wednesday. Will I have bought her a present in time?
Well, no. There's no way, Andy. Because I mean, I know your track record with this. When was the last time you did buy her a present on time?
Well,
we're going way back.
The problem is she always has her birthday during Edinburgh, John, when I'm really busy. You know, I'm just pumping out the laughs left, right and centre. You know, I don't have time to go shopping. Surely a reference to my wife in the Bugle, that is birthday present enough for any girl, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I guess we'll see, Andy. My instincts tell me no, but I know nothing about women. My track record really does explain that. I wouldn't be taking any lady advice from me, Andy.
Anyway, that's all from the Bugle. I've got to go. John, you're going to have to wrap this one up.
What, you're just leaving?
Yeah, no, I've got to do my show.
I don't know if I can.
Bye!
Well, Buglers, Andy's gone. It's just us left here together now. We can enjoy this moment together of slight awkward silence. Well, that's it for the Bugle this week. Bugle 41. Over, I guess next week probably. Probably Bugle 42. Goodbye, Buglers. Goodbye.
This is a Times Online podcast. For more podcasts, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.